friend, I'm here to tell you, in case you don't know it, that you got a new generation of black people in this country who don't care anything whatsoever about Oz. They don't want to hear you old Uncle Tom handkerchief heads talking about the Oz. No. This is a new generation. And when I speak, I don't speak as a Democrat or a Republican. I speak as a victim of America's so-called democracy. You and I have never seen democracy. All we've seen is hypocrisy. When we open our eyes today and look around America, we see America not through the eyes of someone who has enjoyed the fruits of Americanism. We see America through the eyes of someone who has been the victim of Americanism. We don't see any American dream. We've experienced only the American nightmare. We haven't benefited from America's democracy. We've only suffered from America's hypocrisy. And the generation that's coming up now can see it and are not afraid to say it. If you go to jail, so what? If you're black, you were born in jail. If you're black, you were born in jail. In the North as well as the South. Stop talking about the South. Long as you're south of the Canadian border, you're south. This is why I say it's the ballot or the bullet. It's liberty or it's death. It's freedom for everybody or freedom for nobody. America today finds herself in a unique situation. Historically, revolutions are bloody. Oh, yes, they are. They have never had a bloodless revolution or a nonviolent revolution. That don't happen even in Hollywood. You don't have a revolution in which you love your enemy. And you don't have a revolution in which you are begging the system of exploitation to integrate you into it. Revolutions overturn systems. Revolutions destroy systems.
You're tuned to listener-supported community radio KBOO, Portland, Oregon, in the beautiful Willamette Valley.
Join KBOO around the campfire. Become a member during Camp KBOO's Summer Drive, taking place now through June 29th. Your contribution goes toward grassroots community radio. Donate now by going to kboo.fm/give. Thank you.
Thank you. family home front, and I'm quoting now, Tehran will burn. Critics of Israel call this a threat by Israel to utilize its substantial nuclear stockpile during its current assault on Iran. We'll be joined by Flashpoint's Washington contributor Sam Husseini, who has spent the last week or so at the United Nations covering issues all Palestinian. We'll hear a lot about that. We'll also be joined by John Steinbach for deep background on the extremely tight relationship between the U.S. and Israel that puts the lie to the current denials of U.S. participation in Israel's frontal assault on Iran. And that continues. All this and more coming up straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. And you're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. My name is Dennis Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We're coming to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. We are happy to have you along with us on Free Speech Radio. We begin, of course, with this expanding war, this very dangerous war that Israel and the U.S., that's right, both of them, are carrying out against Iran. Joining us is Sam Husseini. Sam is our Washington specialist. He covers the State Department for us. He's been doing some time at the United Nations. Sam Husseini, welcome back to Flashpoints. But what was happening at the United Nations, and I want you to talk about that, has been lost in this expanding potential regional global war.
It's remarkable how Israel has this capacity to commit one crime and then commit another and have the second one distract from the first one rather than it be a cumulative total of, you know, more and more charges on the rap sheet. I guess the U.S. government does similar maneuvers. Last week, 149 countries finally responded to the U.S.'s use of veto. The week before last, the U.S. Vetoed a resolution calling for a ceasefire in Gaza. It was that vote at the Security Council was 14-1. And then last week, the General Assembly finally stepped in with using its Uniting for Peace procedure, which is a method by which the General Assembly can take hold of the situation effectively when the Security Council has failed in its responsibilities to uphold peace and security because a member state has abused its veto powers. The U.S. obviously has. The U.S. has used five explicit vetoes and done a lot of other chicanery since 2023 on Gaza. And so you had 149 countries vote to not only for a ceasefire, but also reprimanding, condemning Israel for its violations of international law and instructing all member states to use all necessary measures to compel Israel to uphold its obligations under international law. Now, I and many other people, Craig Mochaber, the UN whistleblower, and others, called for more explicit action by the General Assembly. For example, they could have called for mandatory sanctions, as they did in the case of South Africa, apartheid South Africa. They could have put together a peace force, as was done in the 1956 crisis when Israel with Britain and France invaded Gaza and Sinai. They didn't do these explicit measures, but they still passed the strongest resolution they have passed to date. Exactly 3 hours later, Israel started bombing Iran. That is how Israel responds. 3 hours. That is how Israel responds to the vast majority of the countries of the world calling on it to uphold international law. So you obviously have a rogue state, is putting it politely. There were a few other countries, the U.S. and a few other countries, even Germany and France and Britain voted for this resolution at the General Assembly last week. So it was an extraordinary vote, even though it didn't have as much teeth as perhaps it should have. So you saw Israel launch this bombing campaign, and they tout going after the nuclear facilities. They killed the negotiator. They hit civilian structures, and when I was at the UN, I regularly went to the briefings of the Secretary General and the President of the General Assembly, and they wouldn't condemn Israel directly. They have become the top echelon of the United Nations, has become sort of an appendage of U.S. policy. They would condemn all undermining of peace, but they would never condemn Israel by name. It's that kind of thing the Office of the Secretary General and others engage in. So that's an extremely troubling sign. And then on Friday, the Security Council had a meeting just about the Iranian situation, which came to naught. There was no resolution put forward or anything. And the countries that had seemed somewhat reasonable on Gaza, like Britain and France and others, took on a much more belligerent approach towards Iran, even though it was obviously, Israel bombed Iran without cause or provocation, allegedly, over its nuclear development, but it doesn't have nuclear weapons, as is obvious, and we'll get into more. Israel has a massive nuclear arsenal. So the UN is, not stepping up to overcome the nefarious machinations of the U.S. and the traditional colonial powers, Britain and France.
Listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, we're speaking with Sam Husseini, who has been doing some good reporting for us and monitoring the situation at the State Department. He's been at the United Nations trying to hold a group of countries trying to hold Israel accountable, but apparently that's not going to happen, Sam. And it is amazing how apparently, I'd just like to get your opinion on this, the way Netanyahu appears to have seized the moment when Trump was doing stuff here to do what he needed to do, what he wanted to do for a very long time. I can't figure out, and I want your opinion on this too, is Trump sort of the other player in this operation, good cop, bad cop? Oh, we want to, we're really trying to make peace. We want to avoid this thing. Oh my God, here it is. We couldn't avoid it. We tried, couldn't stop Israel. So he played sort of a three-card Monty situation.
Yeah, I think that there's a real case for that. I mean, I long viewed Trump as the opposable thumb of the establishment. He appears to be against it. He appears to be opposed to it, but he just helps it grab more. So I think that could well have been what happened here. Trump, he talks out of both sides of his mouth constantly, regularly contradicts himself, obviously. But he was pretending to be wanting a negotiated settlement. And this seems to have had the net effect of having the Iranians have their guard down, thinking that there wouldn't be an attack until after the negotiations. Trump Trump is massively backed by the Adelsons, who are very much in lockstep with Netanyahu and the Israeli establishment. And it could well be that his statements immediately after the attack were quite laudatory of the Israeli attack. So that further indicates that this was, in effect, an operation. And Trump's history, when Iranian commander Soleimani was lured to Iraq on a peace mission during Trump's first term and was assassinated there by Trump's orders. And he sort of similarly cozied up to Gaddafi years ago. Trump did. He let Gaddafi stay in his in one of his estates when Gaddafi was speaking to the United Nations, and Gaddafi didn't want to go to a hotel. He wanted to be in his tent, and Trump actually provided him a place to put up his tent and such. So I think that Trump is excellent at doing this, at making these, people who are in the crosshairs of Washington feel like maybe they got a friend in him, or that he'll give them an ear, and then he throws them under the bus. So this is at least the third time that that kind of thing has happened with him.
Sam, one of the things that blows my mind every time we are immersed in this story, and that's how dutiful the corporate press is when it comes to being silent, playing mum for Israel's very active nuclear weapons program. And apparently they don't hesitate that this is Israel to use their nuclear weapons against the United States. No, I don't mean bomb the United States, but hold them as ransom. Could you talk about, I was listening today, they simply don't mention, they talk about how everybody's got to go in and stop Iran from getting these nuclear weapons, and everybody makes believe Israel doesn't have, 50, 100, 200, as many as 400 of these mass murdering creations.
Yeah, I know you're going to have John join us, and
we're going to talk more about it, but I want to get your response.
Sure.
Yes.
Yeah. No, my role in this has been to regularly ask politicians in the United States, everyone from Mike Pence to Chuck Schumer, a whole assortment, to John Negroponte, to to members of the Squad and the State Department, both under Biden and Trump. Will you acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons? And none of them want to give a straight answer. The U.S. still will not acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons, and it's remarkable because, when it became clear that Israel was developing nuclear weapons, or was likely developing nuclear weapons, JFK, this is during his administration, he sent off a series of letters to Ben-Gurion regarding their facility at Dimona, asking that there be genuine inspections there. And Ben-Gurion kept putting him off. And then when Kennedy insisted and basically said that this jeopardizes our relationship, this is in the summer of 1963, just then, just as that letter was sent, Ben-Gurion resigns for personal reasons, allegedly, delaying the whole process. And then Kennedy tries to start up this conversation with his successor. And then, of course, Kennedy was assassinated in November of 63, and Johnson totally dropped the issue. And then Nixon came to an accommodation with Israel, saying that the U.S. will adopt Israel's position of neither confirming nor denying that it has nuclear weapons. And this policy, in typical fashion, the establishment media has basically effectively adopted it in not discussing Israel's not signing the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. Every Arab country signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, and Israel won't, and Israel has developed nuclear weapons, and he, of course, had Mordecai Vanunu, a great whistleblower who exposed Israel's nuclear arsenal, served 18 years in solitary confinement. He was kidnapped by Israel from Rome after he had exposed it, but the Sunday Times in London had a huge expose exposing it in the 1980s. And then you have Israel and the U.S. establishment continuously pointing fingers at everybody else. You know, they drag the country into war with Iraq on the allegation that Saddam Hussein has nuclear weapons. He didn't. They you know, said much the same about Gaddafi. So they do all of these regime change wars, totally destabilize these various Arab countries, putting them in a state of anarchy, of failed states, so that Israel can dominate the region more and more. And now they're trying to do, you know, pull the same con on Iran, who they've been demonizing for decades. Netanyahu has been claiming that Iran is 6 months away from a nuclear weapon for 30 years or so. So this mantra has finally taken fruition in this way. And, of course, they've done other operations. I mean, Israel assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists several years ago, for example.
And, of course, not only do they have these weapons, but Israel is a nuclear renegade. Right? I mean, you're making this point to some degree, but they don't, you know, other countries with weapons have to answer to weapons inspectors, right? But apparently,
they
are a renegade. They just don't care.
They just don't care. And they're, I mean, you know, I mean, they didn't even sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, unlike everybody else. So technically, they're not in violation of it because they just threw it out the window. You know, I even asked Jimmy Carter about, you know, I said I regularly ask politicians, you know, will you acknowledge that Israel has nuclear weapons? Several years ago, Jimmy Carter, obviously before he died, you know, whatever it was, 10 years ago, was at the National Press Club, and I asked him why he hadn't acknowledged or done something about Israel having nuclear weapons. It was during his administration, the 1970s, that Israel did a nuclear test with apartheid South Africa. They were helping each other with their weapons of mass destruction programs. Israel was giving South Africa nuclear information, and South Africa was giving Israel biological weapons information. And I asked Jimmy Carter why he didn't do this, and he lied to me because he said that he made it a policy of his administration to not disclose what countries did or didn't have nuclear weapons and to not take action against them. I didn't realize it at the time, but I later did research, and it's not true, because during his administration, Pakistan had not yet declared that it had nuclear weapons, because India got nuclear weapons and then Pakistan followed. And then he pulled the plug on aid to Pakistan because of its nuclear weapons program. Right. So he did make that determination, and he did penalize Pakistan, but he never penalized Israel, and he wouldn't even acknowledge that Israel had nuclear weapons. When I asked him, he must have been guilt-ridden about it, because about a year later, he finally came out and said, yeah, Israel's got nuclear weapons, and, you know, this is an issue. So he finally did that, but he did initially falsify what his stance was during his administration as well. So it's been a long streak of U.S. policy of allowing this, as you call it correctly, a renegade status that is literally threatening not just the region but the world in terms of what could happen here. Because if Israel nukes Tehran, what happens? What's Russia going to do? What's China going to do? You know, you could see dominoes falling and it having, you know, not just genocidal implications in the region, but homicidal ramifications globally.
Have you ever poked the bear, if you will, sort of ask any of these corporate types why they've decided to be so silent? Did somebody have them sign an agreement? They all seem to know, because not a word. How could Israel, with as many as 400 nuclear weapons, attack another country, risk regional and global war to stop another country from getting the weapons that they have? Doesn't it seem obvious that some people who were a year ago deeply opposed to Iran getting nuclear weapons are thinking the safest thing that could happen, that might happen now, is for Iran to get them so that they could balance off Israel? Have you heard that one yet?
Yeah, there's certainly a logic there. I mean, they attacked Iraq, claiming that it was developing nuclear weapons, but they effectively got away with it because Iraq didn't have nuclear weapons. And then they did some saber rattling towards North Korea, but North Korea got nuclear weapons and they never attacked it. So there's actually, I mean, now it's totally obvious, but for at least a couple of decades, it's been fairly clear that the way that the U.S. establishment and Israel have acted, you know, tremendously incentivizes countries to get nuclear weapons. You'd sort of have to be crazy if you're an adversary in any way, shape, or form of Israel and you don't have nuclear weapons, you're kind of putting a big target on your back, as I think the Iranians are finding out right now.
And in terms of how could the corporate press be so duplicitous and aware? They know. Everybody knows.
Yeah, I think the corporate press, I mean, I'll be honest with you and your listeners, Dennis, I don't pay terribly much attention. I mean, I used to work at FAIR, the Media Watch Group, and I used to, you know, read the New York Times from cover to cover every day. I don't do that anymore. The establishment media will position themselves and echo some section of the establishment, or play along, you know, these partisan lines that keep people, you know, tied into their partisan boxes and not being able to see the reality in front of them, which is very plain, that Israel, along with the U.S. and the traditional colonial powers, are attacking Iran. Iran obviously has massive oil reserves. Iran is attempting to align itself with BRICS, with Russia and China and South Africa, and other countries in a more independent fashion than the U.S. European dominated system, and they've supported the Palestinians, as well as the so-called Axis of Resistance, Hezbollah and Surallah in Yemen for years, and so they're really in the crosshair. So the U.S. establishment and the U.S. media have it in for them, and, you know, Netanyahu is sort of the tip of the spear in terms of, you know, getting rid of this, you know, potential menace to the U.S. Establishment.
Amazing. Well, listen, Sam, we appreciate all the good work you've been doing at the UN, even though that stuff did not come to fruition and that Israel managed once again to pull the rug out from under the world's desire for there to be a peace and an end to the genocide. I might add that continues. This is the 619th day of the current version of the genocide. And I want to also urge people, later on in the broadcast, we will have day 619, Anita Burroughs reading a poem every day of this genocide. But what we're going to do now is we're going to take a short break, and we're going to continue this discussion with John Steinbach about the deep, long-abiding relationship that Israel has had with the United States, and what that says about these claims. The most bizarre, foolish, silly. Anybody who would believe that the United States isn't a key player in this attack on Iran really isn't all there. I mean, where do those F-35 bomber planes and the where those weapons, all those weapons? They're rushing more weapons and more weapons. I believe they're still rushing weapons over there to replenish the weapons that the Israelis are going to use. So I don't know what involvement means, Sam. We're gonna take a short break, and we're going to see what John has to say about it. Stay with us. Bernstein. This is your daily investigative news magazine. We come to you every weekday from 5 to 6 over the Pacifica Radio Network. That's KPFA in the Bay Area. And we are happy to have you along on Free Speech Radio. Joining us is John Steinbach. He is a longtime independent activist and writer, co-founder of the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area. His 2008 in-depth paper, The Israeli Nuclear Weapons Program, spells out much regarding Israeli policy and its relationship to the U.S. John, welcome to Flashpoints. Thanks for joining us.
Well, thank you, Dennis, and Sam as well.
Yeah, well, we sort of touched the surface there, but you've been engaged in this one for a long time. But I want to come in the door with the same question that I asked Sam. In essence, what is the likelihood? Is it possible, when we hear the U.S. Secretary of State saying that they're neutral here, what does that bring to mind for you? Share some information that might sort of lead you to counteract that kind of statement.
Well, I mean, this kind of rhetoric has been in effect for the last 50 years. The United States pretending to be a neutral arbiter. We're going to negotiate a peace agreement between Israel and the Palestinians, and we're going to be even-handed. The whole concept, the whole precept is absurd. The United States has been the main supplier of Israel weapons and other monies, the number one recipient of U.S. quote U.S. foreign aid of any nation in the world for the last 40 years and more. When you look at the Israeli military, it's essentially overwhelmingly U.S. military. We give them equipment, we give them money, and then they purchase equipment from the arms manufacturers. It's a big shell game. It's the same game that's being played in Ukraine as well. So the idea that the U.S. is neutral or was not involved in this attack on Iran is it's absurd. The entire world knows it, and I think increasingly the U.S. public is becoming aware of it as well.
Do you see the comments, the recent comments by the Israeli Defense Minister Katz over the weekend, where he says if Iranian Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei continues to fire missiles at the Israeli home front, Tehran would burn? Do you believe that's a threat for a nuclear attack?
So it was that statement that had that caused me to reach out to Sam Husseini, because I saw that as a direct threat of using nuclear weapons, and I saw it as not actually directed primarily at Tehran, but primarily directed at the United States. And the reason is that if you read my paper, a fairly large section of it talks about Israeli nuclear strategy and the concept that Shimon Peres came up with in the 1960s and 70s compellence or non-conventional compellence was the word he used. But when Israel uses the term non-conventional, you have to understand that means nuclear. And the idea was, and this was articulated by a number of Israeli spokespeople, I find it very useful when talking about Israeli politics to actually use their own words. And so, for example, during the 80s and 90s, a journalist by the name of Israel Shahak was translating the Hebrew press, because back then only one or two of the major Israeli newspapers were translated into English. So he left us with a plethora of quotes where the Israeli political leadership essentially told us the truth, the same way that occasionally Donald Trump tells the truth. And one of those truths was this concept of non-conventional compellence. And the idea was that we will use our nuclear weapons in order to compel the Arab states to do what we want, and also to compel the United States to do what we want. So you can go all the way back to 1956. In Francis Perrin, who was the director of the French nuclear weapons program. And in 1956, he said, we thought that Israel was developing nuclear weapons to be used against the United States in terms of saying, if you don't do what we want, then we're going to use nukes. And, the most famous example of that happening was in 1973 when Israel was using losing the 1973 war. And the Israeli ambassador sent a note to Kissinger and Nixon and said, essentially, if you don't send us a massive airlift of weapons, we're going to feel free to use our nuclear weapons. And Kissinger and Nixon reluctantly caved into that, and that precipitated a major nuclear crisis, because when the U.S. started airlifting those supplies, Soviet Union went on a major nuclear alert. So that's that. When this threat of burning Tehran came out, I saw it immediately as a threat not so much against Iran, but as directed to the United States and saying, we are demanding that you join us in this attack on Iran, and if you don't, then we will use nuclear weapons.
We are speaking with John Steinbach. He's a longtime independent activist, writer. He is a co-founder of the Hiroshima Nagasaki Peace Committee of the National Capital Area. And we're talking about is now... our understanding is that Israel has anywhere from 90 to 400 nuclear weapons. How do we know that? Because they're nuclear renegades. They don't agree to inspections or anything like that. How do we know this?
They don't. And we owe this primarily to Mordecai Vanunu. And Mordecai Vanunu was a young leftist technician working at the Dimona nuclear plant. And that is the nuclear weapons factory for Israel. It's a plutonium reactor and a production facility, recycling facility. And he smuggled out hundreds and hundreds of photographs and documents, and he turned them over to the Sunday London Times, and the Sunday London Times published them, and they brought in Ted Taylor and Frank Barnaby, who were two of the bomb designers from the Manhattan Project, two of the world's foremost experts on nuclear weapons, and they analyzed the documents, they analyzed the photographs, and that was a bit back in 40 years ago. And with back then, they determined that Israel had as many as 200 nuclear weapons at that point. They also determined that they had thermonuclear weapons, that they, in all probability, had neutron bombs, and certainly miniaturized artillery shell-sized nuclear weapons. So the upshot of it was that their estimate back then was 200. And since then, their estimates up to 500. Groups like Federation of American Scientists usually say 80 to 90. But the point I would like to make is that when we're talking about nuclear weapons, and these are much, much, much larger than the nuclear weapon that killed 200,000 people in Hiroshima and destroyed every structure within 2.5 kilometers of ground zero. These weapons are 10 to 100 times larger than that. So when we talk to, does Israel have 80? Does it have 500? The answer is, it doesn't matter. They've got sophisticated nuclear weapons. They've got miniaturized nuclear weapons. They have 5 or 6 high-tech submarines. They have ballistic missiles that can reach beyond Moscow and even reach to the east coast of the United States, that are targeting every single capital in Europe. And they have bombers and fighter planes that can easily reach Iran. So, people need to be aware that that's the situation. That's the reality.
So if one of these was landed in Tehran, it could disappear a good part of the city or the entire city?
No, we would be talking about millions of people dead, almost certainly millions of people dead, particularly over the next year or so. We'd be talking about fallout crowds. And we'd also be talking about the virtual instant engagement of China and Russia. And the Pakistan Parliament yesterday voted that if Israel uses nuclear weapons, that Pakistan will not hesitate to defend Iran. And Pakistan in itself is a minor nuclear power with around 100 nukes. And of course, India is there in the neighborhood, and they have about 150. So Iran is not isolated. It's not politically isolated. It's not militarily isolated. It's has 10 times the population of Israel. It has a comparable technological base. It has an area, something on the order of 20 times the size of Israel. So Israel is in a very precarious position. If this continues to be tit for tat, Israel loses. And if the United States gets involved directly in it, then we're seeing a minimal of the closure of the Straits of Hormuz, and we're probably seeing about a very, very dire situation, the likes that the world has never seen.
John, I was talking with Sam earlier about this, and I want to tap your experience. It is extraordinary how dutiful and obedient the corporate press has been about this issue. It's really hard to report this story of a war. We have the two strongest countries in the world, nuclear powers, ready to go to war against Iran, that we don't even know how much enriched uranium they have. Do you ever raise this issue with the press about what's the problem here? To tell the story, we need both sides.
Yes, I do. I wrote a report after the Israeli report in about 2015 for the Washington Report on Middle Eastern Affairs, and that was comparing Israel's nuclear arsenal and Iran's nuclear program. And that, I mean, the difference is just in a nutshell. So Israel is a non-signatory to the NPT, the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. It is a renegade. It and North Korea, India, and Pakistan are the only non-signatories, basically, in the entire world. And there is no IAEA checks. There's no investigations. And in fact, Israel does not even acknowledge they have nuclear weapons, even though, you know, it's a totally open secret about their arsenal. On the other hand, Iran is a signatory to the NPT. It is committed to not developing nuclear weapons, and it has, in fact, the Ayatollah issued a fatwa, which continues to this day, which says that nuclear weapons are haram, that it is against Islam to develop nuclear weapons, that Iran will never develop nuclear weapons. Iran, because of its membership in the NPT and because it signed the JCPOA back in 2015 under Obama, which basically opened up all of their facilities to the most intrusive investigations of the IAEA of any nation in the world. But in spite of that, the message on MSNBC and CNN and so on is not that Israel is a major nuclear power that has just launched an unprovoked attack on civilian infrastructure in Iran. But the problem is, you know, Iran might someday develop nuclear weapons. It's the hypocrisy is just absolutely stunning. It's beyond belief. And I know your readership, your listenership understands this, but the vast majority of the American public, you know, has no idea that this is the reality.
If Israel decided to use one of these weapons, wouldn't it experience the potential of significant blowback, and the region would be in trouble, wouldn't it?
Well, depending on the winds, yeah. Absolutely. Whichever way the winds are blowing, if the winds are blowing toward Europe, it's going to affect Greece and Italy. If they turn and generally it would blow away, it would blow toward Jordan and Saudi Arabia, toward India and China. But the winds change all the time, and you have inverted winds all the time. So absolutely, we're talking about a small area. It would potentially affect. It will affect the entire region, and the consequences are not going to be only regional, because geopolitical situation today is radically different than it was 5 years ago. We have the BRICS have emerged. We've had because of Ukraine, Russia and China have been driven or have formed a formal partnership, a formidable partnership. They have included Iran in that partnership. India is part of BRICS, and most of the rest of the world, quite frankly, are banging on the door, and they're saying, we don't trust the United States, we don't trust Europe, we want to get in with BRICS. And that's the geopolitical reality, and that may very well be causing a sense of desperation in Israel as well as in the United States, that the political control is slipping away, and that this is just another desperation move, something like the tariffs and something like all of the unilateral things that Trump is doing. It would seem to me that what we're seeing right now is a symptom of the West's weakness in general and Israel's weakness in particular.
And, of course, we might want to add, John Steinbach, that this use of nuclear weapons by Israel on its so-called allies is not a new story. It goes back to 1973, doesn't it?
Well, it goes back further than that. I would just like to say, though, that Israel is taking a page from the United States playbook. So people might remember back in the 1980s and early 90s, Daniel Ellsberg published a paper. And I think he counted, and Arjun Makhijani did the same thing. And they, I believe, between 26 and 28 times that the United States used the threat of the use of nuclear weapons, mainly against third world countries, in order to get what they wanted. So what Israel's doing is essentially the same thing that the United States has done writ globally.
But the Israelis did threaten Kissinger and Nixon in 73, didn't they, effectively?
Yes, they said if an airlift does not start immediately, and I don't remember the exact words, but there will be very, very bad consequences. And it was understood by Kissinger. Seymour Hersh, in his book, The Samson Option, goes into this in some depths. And Mark Gaffney and several others have also documented this as a direct statement by the Israeli ambassador, and that Nixon and Kissinger had been very reluctant to get involved, and that that this forced their hand, and that they acted reluctantly. And then of course what happened is, because Egypt and Syria were major allies of the Soviet Union, the Soviets went on a major nuclear alert at that time. So that was one of the maybe three or four times that we've come the closest to nuclear war. So there is a precedent here.
Wow. Listen, we know you got to go, but we just one more sort of sum up. What's your most concerning worry, thought, based on the incredible knowledge you have about this situation? What are you most concerned about now? What are you watching? Which fuse has been lit? Yeah.
One of the things that I'm most concerned about is something that Israel Shahak warned us back in the 1980s, and that was the growing emergence of the settler movement, the radical settlers, and some of the extreme radical Zionist elements that were at that time, and that was 30 years ago. He warned us about this, that we're starting to take charge of the government. And so fast forward to today, and we're looking at a government that's infested, and some would argue controlled by neo-Kahanists. These are the acolytes of Meir Kahana. And these are extreme people that have openly expressed sentiments that have a lot in common with Nazi Germany. So that's my concern, is that you have such extreme elements seemingly running the show in Israel that the unthinkable could occur, and we need to be thinking about the unthinkable at this point.
Well, you're helping us do that, John Steinbach. We appreciate the incredibly good in-depth information. We hope you'll come back and visit us again and keep us posted as the story is going to unfold, and there's a major concern about what might happen here. So thank you for taking the time.
You're absolutely welcome.
We appreciate you. You are listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. It is day 619 of the current genocide in Gaza, which we will not take our eyes off, nor will Anita Burrows. We're going to take a short break, and she's keeping track day by day, poem by poem, and we continue to share that work of hers. Stay tuned. Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio, KPFA here in the Bay Area. Happy to welcome back Anita Barros. Anita has been keeping track of the U.S. armed genocide continuing to be carried out by Israel. It's all continuing, all the suffering and all the slaughters that we have been reporting on in Gaza are continuing, as is all this other stuff that we've been talking about. Anita Barros has been keeping track day by day, poem by poem. Anita, welcome back. 619, day 619. Thank you for coming back.
Thank you, Dennis. Yeah, here we are at day 619, and I think I'll read that one first. I wrote it a few hours ago, and then I'll go back earlier in the week and read some others. Day 619. Your father went to get food, and he never came back. Now your mother says she'll go. She promises to be careful. But who can be careful when shots are fired, when drones fly overhead? Even at 8 years old, you know that. You know she's only trying to make you feel all right. She knows you know that. But she's walking there anyway now. She knows she could be killed. She knows how your stomach has been aching for months from hunger. That's the dilemma that a parent in Gaza finds himself in every day. I mean, these food distribution sites are just traps for people. They get killed every day. Some people walk away with a minimal amount of food. So I'm going to read poem 616. This was 3 days ago, and this is for Dr. Ala al-Najjar and her son, Adam al-Najjar. This was the family where 9 out of 10 children and their father were killed in a bombing by Israel a few weeks ago. Dr. Ala and her one surviving child have escaped to Italy, where the boy can get treatment. In a beautiful place, the boy says, there are no bombs, and I go to school. There are desks at school. Kids do their lessons, and then they go to play in the courtyard, and nobody dies. The boy is 11. He has lost all 9 of his siblings. He has lost his father. He has lost his house. He is on a plane now with his mother. They are going to Milan, where doctors will treat his injuries, where he and his mother and his aunt and his cousins will begin a new life. We'll live in a beautiful place, a place with food, with hospitals, with schools. Some of his wounds will heal over the summer. He will learn Italian. He will go to school. His mother, a beautiful place, the boy says, is a place where my mother is not always sad. His mother will work again as a pediatrician, where she will tell her story, where she will care for this one remaining son, where they will remember the place they lived in, which before the genocide was a beautiful place. The words I give to the boy in the poem are his own words. He spoke those words last week, just before he left for Italy. This is day 617. Listeners may know that there was a total internet blackout for at least 4 days in most parts of Gaza. Day 617. Blackout. No way to reach your aunt, your friend, the friend who lives so far away you have never seen her, but daily she sends you something to remind you you're not forgotten. Now there's nothing. There's been nothing for days. Nothing to remind you the world is not just this hell, this darkness, this viciousness, this bleak destruction. Now the courses you were taking cannot be taught. Now the thread that held you for months so tentatively to history, memory, to everything you've dreamed has been frayed. And yet you write. And yet you sit at the desk you miraculously still have and write. Write. That one is written actually to my young writing student in Gaza. Her name is Taqwa Alwawi. This is day 618. This was yesterday. In the shattered corridors of the shattered hospital, patients lie side by side. Impossible at first to tell who is dead and who is living. The nurses and doctors are sick from exhaustion and poison water. Some can barely stand. One breaks down in tears when a child she has been treating finally opens her eyes, sits up, looks around, hour after hour. When do they sleep? What do they eat? What more do they have within themselves to give? Time. Grief, comfort. Some, in a frantic effort to save a patient, are even giving blood from their own broken bodies. I have time for one more, Dennis?
Let's try, yes, please.
Okay, I'll read a shorter one. This